Usually when you walk up to a building, the entrance you choose kind of, well, it dictates the entire journey you're about to take.
Oh, absolutely. It sets the tone for the whole experience.
Right. So imagine there's this massive, profound architectural space, just a huge room, and one entrance is this long, winding garden path.
Okay, I can picture that.
And it takes you, I don't know, hours to walk it. You pass statues, you encounter people from your past, you process your own history step by step. And eventually, after this really long journey, you arrive at the sender.
Like a classic drawn-out narrative experience.
Exactly. But the other entrance, it's like a high-speed pneumatic tube that just bypasses the garden entirely. It strips you of all your luggage and shoots you straight into the exact same center room in like 15 seconds flat.
It is an incredibly jarring contrast when you frame it that way. I mean, the final destination is identical, but the vehicle getting you there just defies comparison.
And that contrast is exactly what we're exploring in today's deep dive. Welcome, if you're listening. We are thrilled to have you here for this one. We're looking at a fascinating new article published today, May 22, 2026, in the OOTW Journal.
And the title of that piece perfectly captures your architectural metaphor. It's called 5-Neo-DMT versus psilocybin. Two doors to the same room.
Right. Because if you're listening to this, you already know we are living through this massive paradigm shift in psychedelic neuroscience. You know the basics. But what this paper does is place two radically different therapeutic models right side by side.
It's essentially a head-to-head comparison of two totally different phenomenological experiences.
Yeah, one gives you a 6-hour narrative journey, the other gives you a 15-minute total dissolution of the self. Yet somehow they are both occasioning the exact same peak mystical experience and, frankly, revolutionizing mental health treatment.
Which forces us to ask some really profound questions about how healing actually happens in the brain. Because we're looking at two entirely different psychological events that are built on the exact same underlying neurobiological architecture.
Okay, let's unpack this because I want to start right there with that shared architecture. The OOTW Journal piece refers to psilocybin and 5-MeO-DMT as pharmacological cousins.
Yes, they're both tryptamines.
Right, so they share that same chemical family tree as serotonin. But if they're so structurally similar, how are they triggering these completely massive life-altering shifts in the brain?
Well, they share a specific structural backbone, and that shared tryptamine architecture allows both of them to act on the 5-HT2A serotonin receptor.
Which is kind of the holy grail receptor for this stuff.
Exactly. That receptor is essentially the gateway to the classical psychedelic state. I mean, if you were to block that receptor with a specific antagonist.
Like give someone a blocker before the medicine.
Right. If you block it, the subjective effects of both psilocybin and 5-MeO-DMT would completely vanish. The medicine would be circulating in your system, but the doors just wouldn't open.
Wow. So think of the 5-HT2A receptor as like the master power switch for neuroplasticity that both of these keys can turn on.
That's a great way to put it.
But what actually happens in the brain when that switch gets flipped? Because the paper cites research out of UC Davis and uses this term psychoplastogenesis.
Psychoplastogenesis,
It
yeah.
sounds like a total sci-fi concept, but this is a tangible biological mechanism,
It
right?
is very real, and it's the physical foundation of why these therapies actually work. When that 5-HT2A switch is flipped, it triggers this rapid biological cascade.
The cascade of what exactly?
Primarily the release of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF.
BDNF, okay.
Now, BDNF promotes the survival of existing neurons, but more importantly, it encourages the growth and differentiation of new neurons and synapses. We're talking about actual physical dendritic spine growth.
Meaning the brain is literally growing new branches to form new connections.
Exactly. You're getting a physical remodeling of your synapses.
Yeah.
And that structural plasticity, the increased dendritic complexity, it doesn't just end when the drug wears off.
It doesn't.
No, it stays open for days or even weeks. That's the critical window of opportunity where a patient's rigid thought patterns can actually be rewritten.
Wow. And both medicines open that exact same window. But how they interact with the body to get there is where the paths severely diverge,
They
right?
vastly diverge, yes.
Let's follow that divergence. The paper points out that psilocybin is technically a prodrug. Can you explain what that means in the context of the patient's actual experience?
Sure. A prodrug basically means the substance you ingest is not actually the substance that affects your brain.
Wait, really?
Yeah. When you take psilocybin, your body has to metabolize it first. Specifically, it strips away a phosphate group in a process called dephosphorylation.
Okay, so it's breaking it down.
Right, converting the psilocybin into psilocin.
Mm-hmm.
And psilocin is the active compound that actually crosses the blood-brain barrier.
Got it.
But that metabolic process takes time, which accounts for the slow, gradual onset of a psilocybin experience.
It's that long walk up the garden path.
Exactly.
But 5-MeO-DMT just bypasses all of that.
It does. 5-MeO-DMT is already the active molecule. It doesn't need to be converted at all. Structurally, it's almost identical to N and DMT.
Which is the famous compound in ayahuasca, right?
Exactly. It's almost identical, except for one crucial difference. It has a single methoxy group attached at the 5 position of its chemical ring.
And here's where it gets really interesting to me. Because of that one little chemical substitution, that single methoxy group 5-MeO-DMT essentially has extra ridges on its key.
That's right.
It doesn't just hit the 5-HT2A power switch we just talked about. It unlocks entirely different rooms in the brain.
And what's fascinating here is how profoundly that single structural change alters the receptor affinity. I mean, psilocin focuses heavily on 5-HT2A, but 5-MeO-DMT has a significantly greater affinity for the 5-HT1A receptor.
Okay, and what does 5-HT1A do?
Well, 5-HT1A is heavily associated with serotonergic tone, calmness, and anxiolytic or anxiety-reducing effects.
Wait, so the drug inherently produces a calmer physiological state than psilocybin?
It does, but it actually goes even further. 5-MeO-DMT also exhibits significant activity at the sigma-1 receptor.
The sigma-1.
Yes, which is essentially a chaperone protein that plays a massive role in the body's stress response. Psilocybin doesn't meaningfully engage the sigma-1 receptor at all.
Huh. If we step back and look at that clinically, you have a medicine that is shooting someone into a state of total ego dissolution in a matter of seconds. Which sounds objectively terrifying.
It does sound intense, yes.
But what you're saying is that the molecule itself provides its own neurological shock absorbers.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize it. Yes, the activation of 5-HT1A and sigma-1 physically mitigates the panic response.
Yeah.
It smooths out the sheer terror of total ego dissolution.
That's wild.
It really is. This unique receptor profile explains why 5-MeO-DMT produces an experience that is far less prone to somatic anxiety in clinical settings. It completely changes the entire texture of the experience compared to psilocybin.
Which naturally brings us to the most mind-bending difference between the two, which is the subjective experience of time and like the actual shape of the trip.
The phenomenology split.
Right. Exactly. Because if a patient is taking oral psilocybin, they are buckling in for a 4 to 6 hour event. It has a very distinct classic narrative arc.
There's an onset, a long ascent, a peak somewhere around 90 minutes, a plateau, and then a very long gradual descent.
Right. And that extended temporal arc is exactly what allows for deep biographical work. A psilocybin journey is heavily narrative. It's highly visual too, right?
Very much so. Patients will often describe seeing complex fractal geometry. They might mentally encounter their own memories, speak to deceased loved ones,
and process past traumas.
Exactly, or interact with archetypal figures. The visual field is intensely processed. But the key factor here is that throughout all of this, the patient retains a sense of self.
Okay, meaning they know who they are while it's happening.
Right. Afterward, they can say to the therapist, I saw this, or I felt that. There's always an experiencer witnessing the event.
And then you contrast that with vaporized 5-MeO-DMT. You inhale it, and it crosses the blood-brain barrier in, what, seconds?
Literal seconds, yes.
It peaks in maybe 1 or 2 minutes. It plateaus for 10. And the patient is entirely back to baseline ordinary consciousness in 15 to 30 minutes total.
Completely back to baseline.
There is no arc. It's a step function. You go straight from sitting in a chair to total dissolution.
And phenomenologically, it is completely different from psilocybin. It's non-dual, meaning there is no narrative and there is no figure-ground separation. At therapeutic doses, the visual content is incredibly minimal.
Really? So no fractal geometry?
Usually no.
Yeah.
Patients often describe it as just a boundless white or golden light. The defining characteristic of 5-MeO-DMT is that the distinction between the observer and the observed completely collapses.
So there's no eye left to experience it.
Precisely.
See, I have to push back on this a bit, just thinking about it from the perspective of a patient seeking deep psychiatric help. If I am struggling with severe depression, a 15-minute experience sounds like a blip compared to a massive day-long psychological journey.
It does sound incredibly short, yeah.
Right. How can you possibly do the necessary therapeutic work without a narrative arc to ride? Don't you need the time to actually process your trauma?
Well, that is the core difference in how these therapies function. And it all comes down to the mechanism of integration.
Okay, integration. How the patient makes sense of what just happened.
Exactly. With psilocybin, because you have that long multi-hour descent, the integration is actually happening during the session.
Oh, I see.
The patient has hours to feel a memory, to cry, to sit with an emotion, and to essentially metabolize the presence of the therapist sitting next to them.
They are essentially unpacking their luggage while they're still riding the train.
That's exactly it. But 5-MeO-DMT does not afford you that luxury. It functions more like a complete system reset. It delivers the destination without the journey.
Right, the high-speed pneumatic tube.
Yes. You don't get to process things in real time because during those 15 minutes, there is no you there to do the processing.
That's heavy.
It is. Therefore, the therapeutic integration doesn't happen in the room. It happens entirely in the days, weeks, and months after the medicine has completely left the patient's system.
So the real work starts after the drug wears off.
Right. It requires extensive post-experience psychotherapeutic work to take that profound 15-minute flash of non-duality and translate it into lasting behavioral change in their daily life.
That makes incredible sense clinically. But, I mean, it also sounds notoriously difficult to measure.
It is a challenge, for sure.
Because if 5-MeO-DMT strips away a patient's internal narrative and compresses everything into a tiny window of pure non-duality, how can scientists objectively prove it's as effective as a 6-hour psilocybin session?
Right. How do you quantify that?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Are researchers essentially trying to put a ruler next to God? How do you put a numerical value on a concept like transcendence?
This raises an important question, and honestly, it was a massive hurdle for the field for decades. But neuroscientists and psychologists actually developed validated psychometric instruments to quantify these exact subjective states.
Okay, like a standardized test for mysticism.
Pretty much. The most notable is the Mystical Experience Questionnaire, or the MEQ30. It was heavily utilized and refined by Roland Griffiths and his team at Johns Hopkins.
The famous Hopkins Psychedelic Research.
Yes. And the MEQ30 measures four distinct dimensions of an experience. Mystical quality, which covers feelings of unity and sacredness, positive mood, transcendence of time and space, and finally, ineffability.
Ineffability, meaning the inability to even put it into words.
Exactly.
Which brings us to the Davis et al. Study from 2018, because the OOTW Journal highlights this as one of the single most consequential comparative data points in all of psychedelic literature.
It truly changed the landscape. Alan K. Davis and his colleagues took the MEQ30 and applied it to a cohort that had received vaporized 5-MeO-DMT.
Okay, at what dose?
Using a mean dose of around 12 milligrams. Mm. And they discovered that it occasioned a, quote, complete mystical experience in about 75% of administrations.
Which is an incredibly high success rate for any clinical intervention.
It is staggering. But the absolute breakthrough was when they compared those 5-MeO-DMT results against a prior Hopkins study that used psilocybin.
Okay, here we go. What did they find?
They found that a 15-minute 5-MeO-DMT experience produced a mystical intensity that was statistically equivalent to a high dose of psilocybin.
Wait, equivalent to a high dose, like a hero's dose?
Yes, we are talking 30 milligrams of psilocybin per 70 kilograms of body weight. And the 5-MeO-DMT matched it across every single MEQ30 subscale.
That's unbelievable.
And it scored significantly higher than a moderate dose of psilocybin.
So a quarter of an hour of 5-MeO-DMT hits the exact same depth of mystical intensity as a full 6-hour hero's journey on psilocybin.
Exactly.
The compression of time doesn't equal a dilution of the experience.
Not at all.
The article even notes that Roland Griffiths viewed this specific finding as a massive paradigm shift, because it proves that the therapeutic variable most strongly linked to clinical outcomes, which is that peak mystical intensity is not actually dependent on the duration of the drug's effect.
And that realization fundamentally alters how we design clinical care. I mean, knowing that both medicines reliably trigger these peak states is fascinating biology. But applying them to severe mental health epidemics is where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah, let's talk about those clinical breakthroughs, because the data coming out of these trials is just staggering. I want to look specifically at the GH001 phase 2B trial mentioned in the article.
Ah, yes. the GH001 trial.
This is a proprietary, vaporized, synthetic 5-MeO-DMT formulation, right?
Correct.
And it was aimed squarely at treatment-resistant depression, or TRD. The primary endpoint data showed a negative 15.5-point placebo-adjusted reduction on the MADRS depression scale.
To give that number some much-needed context, traditional daily SSRIs might eke out a 2 or 3-point advantage over a placebo over the course of several months.
2 or 3 points versus 15.5?
Exactly. A 15.5-point placebo-adjusted drop from a short-acting intervention is virtually unheard of in modern psychiatry. It represents a massive, visible change in a patient's daily functioning.
And the article says 57.7% of those patients achieved full remission from their depression.
Full remission, yes.
But the durability of that remission is what I find most incredible. At the 6-month follow-up, 77.8% of those treated patients were still in remission.
Still in remission half a year later.
And they achieved that from just 1 to 4 brief treatment sessions total.
Those numbers exceed almost any clinical depression treatment trial we have on record. I mean, it outperforms ketamine, it outperforms esketamine, and it even outperforms prior psilocybin trials specifically for TRD.
So what does this all mean for the future of mental health? We're talking about a clinic visit that might take an hour total.
Right.
You walk in, do some prep, have a 15-minute 5-MeO DMT session, do some immediate grounding integration, and you go home. And it is vastly outperforming modern psychiatric treatments. Are we looking at the end of the traditional daily SSRI?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture of global healthcare, we have to temper that excitement with a bit of clinical pragmatism.
Fair enough.
We aren't looking at the complete eradication of daily medications. What we're looking at is the introduction of highly targeted disease-modifying tools. Psilocybin and 5-MeO-DMT are not competing drugs trying to corner the same market.
They aren't.
No, they're indicated for entirely different types of suffering.
Oh, I see. It's about deciding which door to open for which specific patient.
Precisely. Psilocybin is deeply indicated for clinical material that requires narrative processing.
Like what?
Complex trauma with relational components, deep grief, identity reconstruction, or addiction where there are strong ego-syntonic components.
Right. Like the Hopkins data showed an 80% abstinence rate in smoking cessation at 12 months using psilocybin.
Exactly. If a patient needs to process the story of their life, they need the long therapeutic arc of psilocybin.
And the OOTW piece points out that Compass Pathways is currently in phase 3 trials for TRD using synthetic psilocybin, and there's been massive success in alcohol use disorder as well. So psilocybin treats the stories we tell ourselves.
But 5-MeO-DMT is indicated for ego-bound suffering.
Ego-bound.
Yes. Rumination-driven depression, severe existential anxiety, extreme treatment-resistant depression where multiple other modalities have completely failed. It treats the very illusion of the self.
Wow.
By completely dissolving the observer, it provides an experiential proof to the patient that they are not just their thoughts. They get to experience a reality outside of their ruminative loops.
It's the difference between a therapist helping you reframe a concept intellectually and experiencing a hard, undeniable physical fact.
That's a great distinction. And plus, from a healthcare infrastructure standpoint, there's a massive logistical difference here.
Oh, definitely. A psilocybin session requires a patient to give up an entire day.
Yes, and it requires a clinic to tie up a room and 2 highly trained facilitators for 6 to 8 hours.
That creates a massive bottleneck for patient access. But 5-MeO-DMT bypasses that constraint entirely.
It does. And there are also incredibly promising developments regarding that access. The article highlights an intranasal 5-MeO-DMT formulation that is currently being studied in proof-of-concept trials concomitantly with SSRIs.
Wait, with SSRIs? Because historically, patients on SSRIs were excluded from psychedelic trials, right?
Right, because of concerns about serotonin receptor downregulation blunting the effect of the psychedelic.
Got it.
But if this intranasal pathway holds up and proves effective while a patient is still on their daily medication, it removes a major barrier. Patients could access the therapy without having to endure the grueling process of tapering off their antidepressants first.
That would fundamentally change the scale at which this therapy could be delivered.
Absolutely.
But, you know, speaking of scale, we have to address the complex reality of where this molecule actually comes from.
Yes, the sourcing.
Because with these unprecedented clinical successes, the demand for 5-MeO-DMT is just exploding globally.
And this brings us to the ethical substrate of the medicine, which the OOTW Journal covers pretty extensively.
Right, because the modern cultural surge of 5-MeO-DMT didn't start in a sterile laboratory. It started in the Sonoran Desert with Bufo alvarius.
The Sonoran Desert Toad.
Exactly. The defensive venom secretions of this specific toad contain about 15 to 20% 5-MeO-DMT alongside a whole cocktail of other alkaloids.
Right.
And there is this huge cultural mythology surrounding it. You see the whole smoking toad venom trend online, the rise of psychedelic tourism, the massive influx of retreats down in Mexico.
It's become quite a phenomenon.
But I have to ask this directly because it's something people are deeply curious about. If the synthetic version used in these clinical trials is exactly the same molecule, atom for atom, why is there still this obsession with extracting it from a desert amphibian?
It's a very valid question.
Is there some kind of biological entourage effect from the venom that the synthetic lacks?
Well, the entourage effect is often cited by practitioners who prefer the toad. They suggest that the other alkaloids in the venom shape the overall experience.
Okay, but does the science back that up?
From a clinical standpoint, those secondary alkaloids are highly unpredictable and, frankly, occasionally cardiotoxic.
Oh, wow. Cardiotoxic. That's not great.
No, it's not. The preference for the toad is often driven by a tension between a very potent Western desire for ancient indigenous authenticity and the hard realities of biological chemistry.
Right. And it's important to note we aren't taking sides here, just reporting what the article outlines.
Of course. And the OTW article points out an interesting historical fact. The modern Bufo ceremony is actually quite recent. It was largely developed in the 1980s following the publication of a specific underground pamphlet.
Wait, the 1980s?
Yes. There is surprisingly limited anthropological evidence for substantial traditional indigenous use of this specific toad venom prior to that.
Yet this massive psychedelic tourism industry is putting severe conservation pressure on wild toad populations right now. People are going into the desert and doing these capture milking release cycles that heavily stress the animals.
And these toads have highly specific hibernation and habitat requirements. You can't just easily farm them to meet global psychiatric demand.
Which is exactly why the clinical standard across the board is pure synthetic 5-MeO-DMT.
Exactly. It's chemically identical to the primary active compound the toad produces. It binds to the 5-HT receptors in the exact same way to trigger psychoplastogenesis,
But synthetics provide perfect dose precision.
which is absolutely crucial when the difference between an optimal dose and an overdose is just a matter of milligrams.
Right, and it provides absolute purity without those unpredictable toxins.
And most importantly, it has zero conservation impact on the wild species.
The OOTW Journal takes a very firm, objective stance on this. They fully support indigenous-led conservation efforts, but they strongly advocate for synthetic-only sourcing moving forward, even in ceremonial or retreat contexts.
Their conclusion is stark. They state that the medicine works regardless of substrate, and the species does not have to die for human consciousness research to live.
The clinical question of efficacy between the two appears to be completely settled.
The future of this therapy, both for ecological sustainability and the rigorous dose control required for global psychiatric scaling, relies entirely on the synthetic molecule.
So, bringing all of this back to you, the listener, whether you're a neuroscientist, a clinician exploring new modalities, or just someone who's insanely curious about how we can better heal the human mind, the takeaway from the current data is becoming clearer every single day.
The old debate over whether psychedelic therapy works is largely settled by the numbers.
The real question for the future of psychiatry isn't if we open the door, it's which door we choose to open based on the patient's specific suffering.
And that leads us to one final, highly theoretical concept from the literature that we actually haven't touched on yet.
Oh, what's that?
A clinical approach that some practitioners are calling the stack.
The stack. How does that work?
It asks a provocative question. What if you don't have to choose just one door?
Wait, using both?
Yes. Some practitioners, particularly an emerging cohort of integrative psychiatrists, are now exploring sequencing the medicines. They use 5-MeO-DMT first.
The complete system reset.
Yes. They induce a brief, total dissolution of the ego-bound identification. It shatters the rigid, ruminative thought loops and establishes an entirely new non-dual baseline where the patient realizes their thoughts are not their entire reality.
Okay, and then.
And then, days or weeks later, they follow that up with a classical psilocybin session.
Oh, wow. So you use the 15-minute door to clear the foundation. to completely level the deeply rutted neural pathways. And then you use the six-hour door to let them wander through the garden and rebuild the narrative of their life on that newly cleared ground.
Precisely. While formal, large-scale clinical trials on this sequenced approach haven't been published yet, neurobiologically and psychologically, it is incredibly coherent. One medicine establishes the existential frame, and the other does the narrative work within it.
It's brilliant. You take the high-speed pneumatic tube up to the penthouse just to prove that the view exists. And then a week later, you take the stairs back down to actually appreciate the architecture and figure out where you fit inside of it.
Two profoundly different molecules. Two very different doorways. But ultimately, they lead to the exact same room of profound neuroplasticity, connection, and healing.
Which leaves us with a pretty profound philosophical question to mull over as we wrap up today's deep dive.
Let's hear it.
If a simple 15-minute chemical interaction with a synthetic tryptamine can permanently demonstrate to your brain that yourself, you know, the entire narrative you have built your identity around is just a story, well, who is the you that gets up and walks out of the clinic?
That is the question, isn't it?
It really is. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. The mind is a vast place, and as the science shows, there are plenty of rooms left to explore. Keep questioning, keep learning, and we'll see you next time.